All right. So I'm going to take on a much less serious philosophical topic than what we just heard, and go after something really quite simple. So we tend to believe, without terribly good evidence, that our lives persist beyond death. And so what gives ground to this? We have stories that we've heard. We've got intuitions that we carry with us. And so there are a lot of things from the cognitive science religion perspective that have been suggested as far as why we have these. And there's been some evidence. And I think that evidence has been quite interesting. But I want to dive into it a little bit more. And so we've talked quite a bit. I think I'm going to skip through some of these initial intuitions because most of us are familiar with them. But we have this ontological category of person, and you know, this has a lot that it entails. And these inherited features of this category of person sometimes give us really solid intuitions, and in other cases, they give us intuitions that may go far beyond what maybe they were originally intended for or the way that they were developed, and so they might be artifacts of a sort. And so at this point, I'm going to blow through this and assume that most people know what theory of mind is in the room, but one of the key elements in the way that I like to conceptualize it, based on some of Jesse Baring's work, he's pointed out that it's difficult for us to imagine the absence of certain experiences. And so these are going to be what he calls difficult to imagine the absence of states. And then there are some other experiential states that are more simple to imagine their absence. And so, you know, I was hungry before lunch. I ate lunch. I experienced the absence of hunger. I can close my eyes and negate some of my perceptual experience. So these are things that can be sort of blotted out. But it's very hard for me to imagine not having any emotional status whatsoever or having complete absence of any desire status or knowledge status. What is it like to not to know? Well, that's not something that I readily experience. And so he's made this argument that these easy to imagine the absence of EIA states, drift off rather quickly after a death event. And these difficult to imagine the absence of states persist. And so we have birth, death, we have this lifespan, and these guys are just going to sort of float away, and these are going to persist. Now, one of the things that I think is important to note as we conceptualize this is that these difficult to imagine the absence of states just so happen to be ones for which we have very sparse information. So you can imagine that Jim could tell me what his desires are, and I could observe him for a long period of time, and I actually don't get a huge amount of data that speaks exactly to his desire. Whereas if Jim says that he sees something and he walks over and picks it up, this behavior immediately speaks to that perceptual ability, that perceptual status, in a much deeper way. So there's a difference in the density of data that we can collect and the intuitions that we can draw. And so I don't know that these are fundamentally different in terms of their kind, but they are different in terms of the ease with which we can access data that speak to them or make observations that speak to them. So I'd like to point that out just as a starting point. So our question for the study is basically, if the dead persist as persons and retain some desire or intentional stance, emotional states, epistemic states, can they actually change? So in the way that we can change during our lifespan, can the dead also change after the death event? And so if that's true, under what conditions can they actually gain new information? And can they gain information in the ways that we can readily gain information? Or do they have new avenues for acquiring information? So these are the questions that we set out. And so some of this comes from you know, this idea. Let's take Boyer's example of a ghost. So a ghost is, in Boyer's terminology of counterintuitive or breaches, so it's a person that doesn't actually follow any sort of coherent physics. And one of the things that's sort of amusing to me about this notion is that ghosts can see, right? And ghosts can hear. And how would one hear unless there are air molecules of matter that would be able to take a signal and transfer? So ghosts shouldn't be able to see walls, much less be inhibited by them. Ghosts shouldn't be able to hear anything that we say as in the same way that they shouldn't be able to be moved by the wind. And so there's this weird sort of decoherence of what an intuitive physical world is as we start to posit these. So this is part of what we're trying to go after is, okay, so obviously the physical world is absolutely fractured. So what about the epistemic world? And can they actually understand things that they weren't present for or didn't have access to when the event happened? Can we mess with what time is as well? And does it fracture in an interesting way too? So our question is that our hypothesis becomes a little bit more specific. So we hypothesize that new knowledge or methods for accessing new knowledge are attributed to deceased individuals following the death event. We look at stories of ghosts and hauntings and how they arise. And in many, many cultures, we tend to see that these stories are centered on intentional wrongdoing and the persistence of an individual who has died that is associated with that. So, you know, we have a murder or something like this, and there is the haunting of that murderer, and there's some sort of moral imperative embedded within a lot of these stories. And so maybe this is one of those things that's going to access this type of information and lead to potentially some sort of breakdown in theory of mind such that we can start attributing things inappropriately. So I know it as an observer because I read the story. The person in the story didn't know it. But now, because of this particular intentional stance that they were victim to, they've now acquired that information, even though we've explicitly stated in the story that they didn't know. So we haven't managed to finish data collection yet, so please note that this is on its way. So we've got, at this point, 32 students from Bethel University. It's a small evangelical Christian college in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And so here's some demographic information. So aged 18 to 22 years old, average age 20.4. We've got almost a 50-50 split for males and females. We are comparing them to a set of Japanese students from Rikkyo University in Tokyo. These are, again, 18 to 22 years old. They're a little bit younger, but not much of a difference here. So we're looking at this. So you can see an evangelical Christian university. We've got many more Christians than any other category. Among the Japanese students, we're getting a different distribution, very much. So we had one Christian in our group. So we're collecting more data from another university with whom we're collaborating. So again, we've got almost a 50-50 split with males and females. So here, let me give you an overview of how we conducted our studies now that you've got a bit of an intuition for who the people are. So students read a short first-person narrative, an omniscient narrative. That's wrong, the first person. So they read a narrative about the death of a main character of a story. The students then answered a series of questions about the death event and the main character's biological status, perceptions, emotions, desires, and knowledge, and those states after death. The students then answered a couple of questions regarding their own feelings and conceptions of death, and then we got some demographic information from them. All narratives and questionnaires were presented in the students' native language, so for Japanese students read everything in Japanese. We had a wonderful young undergraduate, aspiring linguist, who was very happy to do very good translations for us. So that was really nice. Just to give you a sense of the story, let me just blow through this quick. So Sam's a university student, some background information. We wind up talking about a lot of He goes to a platform. He's waiting for a train. He's experiencing all of these different things. So he's looking forward to going home. We're articulating physical feelings that he has, his physical state, psychobiological states, emotional state, desires, and some of his knowledge. And what we then do is we have this. Just then, Sam hears a rumbling, turns to see if his train is approaching. Everyone behind him rushes forward, ready to board the train, and now we have this context surrounding the death. And inevitably what happens is he's knocked off the platform as the train hurtles into the station. It hits him with such force that it kills him. He lies dead on his back in the hot sun, blazing down his body on the tracks. A shocked crowd gathers, looks down at Sam's body. Paramedics are called, hurriedly arrive at the scene, and this is where things end in our story. And so we put in three different conditions for this narrative. And these conditions simply talked about the identity of the individual and their intentional status of the person that wound up killing our character by pushing him off the platform. So in the first case, Sam sneezes again, just as everyone starts pushing behind him. The crowd surges forward. He tumbles off the platform. So we don't know the identity of the killer as readers of the story, and it seems to be an accident. The second case, we have a known individual. So in this case, now it's the schoolmate who unwittingly bumps Sam off the platform and Sam dies. In the third case, this schoolmate quickly steps forward and shoves Sam off the platform. So now in this case, Sam does know the individual, but it's also an intentional push that has wound up leading to Sam's death. And so these are the three conditions. So we wanted to look at these, and I'll wind up grouping some of these for analysis and as we go. So we used some standard batteries. So we used items that Baring used in his 2002 study that other groups have used. We also used a couple of items from the belief in afterlife scale and selected items from the death anxiety scale. We also put in the three extra questions that were of very big interest to us. So we wanted to look at emotional status. So, you know, if it was an accident, Sam doesn't really have any reason to be upset with his schoolmate. So we thought. This question will wind up being interesting, and this anger is a little bit more specific. So the upset is just supposed to get at, well, there's a large emotional response to this. And then finally, does Sam know the identity of the person who pushed him? So you remember, if we go back, in the first case, it was just a complete accident. We didn't say anything about it. But in the second two cases where it was Sam's schoolmate that was the one that was responsible for his death, we explicitly said, Sam doesn't know. And so we've put that in. We told the students that this was a reading comprehension task, and so we would be asking them a number of questions about it. So they're supposed to be reading very specifically. So we're really interested in this. So just to begin, let's look at the death anxiety and afterlife belief scales. So American and Japanese students, we didn't see any difference in the anxiety that they express about death. So relatively low levels, not surprising for college kids. So then the Japanese students were much less likely to commit to the existence of an afterlife. They were much more likely to say death is the end. Existence ceases in all of its forms. So this is a very explicit measure, though. And this is going to stand in stark contrast to when we start asking them questions about, well, does Sam's brain still work? Most of the time, people are going to say, no, absolutely not. So there's a discontinuity that occurs with the death event. But if you ask a question like, does Sam continue to love his mom? Now you get a whole lot more people saying yes, even though they may have formally said, no, death is the absolute end of life. There is no more existence. They're still answering yes to this. So what we see is sort of this standard version of this curve where the biological stuff, that stops. The perceptual stuff winds up usually stopping quite frequently. But when we get over to these three categories of the emotional states, the desires, and the epistemic states that are a tribute to the deceased, these persist beyond the death event. Now, there's something interesting that's going on here with our American students, and I'm going to come back to this. But this is very different from what other groups have found, and this was really solid, actually, through our student group. And I have a speculative reason for that, but we'll get into that a little bit later. So just to give you a sense of what other people have found, just pull this dot down to about here, and that's what these data normally look like. All right, so now to the questions that are of particular interest. Oh, I should make one last comment. So we've grouped across treatment conditions. There were no differences. All of the groups landed smack on top of each other. The treatment condition didn't alter any of the responses to those standard items. Now, when we get to these questions, we wind up seeing that Sam is not upset with his schoolmates. So in this case, I've thrown out all of the data from that first treatment condition where Sam was pushed by an unknown person. So what we see here is that very few people in the intentional or the non-intentional conditions are saying that Sam is, in fact, upset with his schoolmate. So now, when we move on to the next question, we actually see something that's a little bit interesting, I think, culturally. The American students wind up saying, for the most part, either in the cultural, in the intentional condition or the non-intentional condition, Sam's not angry at the person that pushed them. But the Japanese students, when Sam was killed by this bumbling idiot who just sort of runs into the back of him, knocks him off, they get upset, but when it's malicious, they don't. And so there's some really interesting cultural issues that rise up here. And for those of you who are interested in Japanese culture, we can talk about those, but I don't feel well enough educated to speculate on that. But it's an interesting thing. It's significant, but it's not actually statistically valid because we don't have enough subjects for all of the cells of the chi-squared. You guys know this. So, all right, now we get to the question that is really of significant interest to me, and that is, does Sam know the identity of the person who pushed him? And what we see is that this distribution winds up being, when it's intentional, 50-50. So it's almost an even split. Half of our subjects are saying, yes, Sam does know who pushed him off the platform, the identity of this person. However, in the non-intentional, it's much, much more that, no, he doesn't really know who this is. So this is a subset of students that are winding up saying that, yes, Sam has somehow acquired this knowledge that was not accessible until after death. So what this does is it puts us in an interesting position. The students, so both American and Japanese students, so we saw similar results across both student groups. They were more likely to attribute knowledge of the killer's identity to the victim. My initial thought, and the reason that we wound up putting in the emotional questions, was I thought there would be some sort of sense of injustice and that would operate through an emotional conduit and basically force us into, okay, well, now I feel so strongly about this that I will then attribute to this knowledge state. And so what was surprising to me was the fact that there wasn't this emotional response. We didn't attribute emotions to Sam. The students generally didn't do that. They just attributed knowledge. So this was a very interesting sort of split, very much unanticipated. So this is the way that I parse it out, and I'd love to talk with those of you who've spent a lot more time thinking about some of these theory of mind issues. So two explanations that I can come up with quickly to explain these data. First of all, we can have a failure in theory of mind in which knowledge is inappropriately attributed to the victim when the victim's death was intentional. So this inappropriate attribution is conditional. and it's conditioned upon the particular intentional stance of the person who led to the death. So that would be a more technical theory of mind and a failure in our standard cognitive mechanisms. The other explanation is that an implicit belief or intuition that individuals who are killed intentionally have methods for accessing that knowledge which are unavailable to the living. So this means that they have some sort of new epistemic path. And so in the way that, you know what, I can't go back to the previous talk re-experiencing that and then suddenly, oh, I know exactly what was going on if I missed it. It seems that perhaps the dead have an opportunity to do that. Now, there are a lot of possibilities for how this could happen. Justin, I think, last night said, the spirit world is filled with gossips. And so it may be the fact that there is some spirit with whom that this new spirit, this newly disembodied spirit, can interact and get that information. And so that's one possibility that maybe we've tapped into sort of unwittingly. But this suggests something of a society through which information can be transferred. So this is an interesting approach. So the final thing, what happened to desire for the evangelicals? Some of you may know John Piper's work in Desiring God, and desire is a very, very interesting thing that exists within evangelical culture and theology. And in many cases, desire is synonymous with that which is bad. And so, to me, my speculation, and this is pure speculation on my part, is that for some of these evangelical kids, death represents this cessation of that which torments us. And so death, I'll be in a better state, I'll be with God, and this desire, which has been at the center of so many of my problems, will dissipate and I'll be left. And so I wonder if one of the differences between our study and other studies, other previous work, is that we're looking at a group of students, a group of Christians, that are view desire as such a bad thing that they're absolutely happy to get rid of it. So to summarize, the dead apparently can acquire knowledge about events that occurred prior to death. This attribution occurred only after when the deceased individual was intentionally pushed off the train platform. It doesn't seem to coincide with attributions of strong generalized emotions, being upset, or a specific emotion, anger. And so this seems to be either a new epistemic method that's available or a specific failure of attributions that go along with theory of mind. So this, I would submit, may be a central contributor to stories of ghosts and hauntings. So with that, a couple of collaborators that I'd like to thank, Cameron Larson, an undergraduate student, Joel Fredrickson, social psychologist in the department, and our translator. So thank you very much.
Okay, we can push into the break just a little bit with a couple questions.
Yes.
This is a fascinating study, but I have a worry about it. That is a very specific formulation of your question. Does Sam know the identity of the person?
Yes.
That question's ambiguous. And it should have been, does Sam know that person pushed him?
Yes.
And because of the ambiguity, it seems to me it's a pretty serious problem for the findings.
So here's if that is a problem, and I readily admit that it's a problem with the way that that sentence was structured, why would we see the results that we do? But why do we see it specifically and primarily in the intentional status? So the only way that I can push back is by saying, if that question basically boils down to, do I know Justin? Well, I know Justin regardless of what he does to me. So his intentional status doesn't actually matter for the way that I answer that question. And yet we found a difference that is consistent. And so, yes, the sentence from a syntactic, from a structural perspective, is not solid. But the results seem to speak to the students may have had that ambiguity available as a formal possibility, but tended to interpret it in sort of the way that we were hoping. So, Myron?
So there were two instances in which the individual was known, which would give rise to the possibility of ambiguity, but only in one case where the known individual intended to harm. So there was a big difference in both cases of the known individual.
Yep. So, and that's what we saw. So we saw no difference in the responses between the in the case where the person who pushed was absolutely unknown, and the person who pushed was known but had an unintentional stance in contributing to the death.
Can you get the questions back for
us? Yeah. So you can eviscerate me?
Yeah.
Somebody didn't go through, what was the great Canadian education that... So these are the questions. Yeah.
The second question is ambiguous.
Yes.
Could you, if you put a now in there, is Sam now angry at the person who pushed him?
Yeah.
Does Sam now know the identity of the person who pushed him?
Mm-hmm.
So there's this sense that, okay, he's lying there dead.
Yeah.
Does he know this now?
Yeah. That would clean up.
But are all the questions prefaced to say we're buried now that he's dead?
Yes. So they're all prefaced with, the now that he's dead.
Yeah. So that's kind of in there.
So. And they get all three of these questions, correct?
Yes. Okay. Every student I see these questions.
And always in this order?
Yes, always in this order. Because we wanted to make sure that if there was a conduit through emotion that... Yeah. Adam.
I thought an interesting follow-up on this might be one story on which it's the person who gets pushed is easy to empathize with, and one person in which it's they're hard to empathize with, or like get their just desserts, something like this. Because I wonder if one possible explanation of what's going on. It doesn't seem to me that people have some theory about gossiping experience, this somehow is how we get an effect. But something that seems more plausible to me is something like you have quarantine failure, you have empathy plus quarantine failure, maybe filtered by some thought, about really bodily link states not applying, but the epistemic ones remain even after the filtering. So, if I empathize a lot with the guy, it's a wrongful death, right? Maybe even a wrongful death by a friend. Then I have this strong reaction to what the guy, to what's happened. But what if I don't have a strong reaction? Does the effect remain? I'm not an external tools person, but if you accept suggestions from the beholder, that would be interesting.
5 years ago, I had never done a human study. I'd only worked with rats, so I'm very, very willing to accept suggestions from people who know more than I do. So is that all our time? All right. Thank you.
Thank you. This concludes session 3.